This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, the new movies I'm going to be talking about are Ted 2, Max, Big Game, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, and The Wolf Pack. A little bit of a Sundance favorite selection there at the end. I'm also going to be talking about news, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, as well as Instagram with fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's roll into the news with a couple sad things to note. First of all, rest in peace to James Horner. This is, of course, the Academy Award-winning composer who did movies like Aliens and Braveheart. His big one that set him on the map was Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Great score. This guy was amazing. He also did Titanic and Avatar, worked a lot with James Cameron. And so many people focus on John Williams as that soundtrack of a generation. And he was mainly in the 80s. John Williams, yeah, he had Jurassic Park that came out in 93. And while John Williams is working today, his stuff isn't as iconic now that it was in the 80s. James Horner, his stuff was iconic through the 90s, at least, and into the 2000s. So this guy was the next John Williams, only not as recognizable to people in the mainstream. Now, he was 61 years old. He died in a plane crash. Apparently, he was piloting his plane. So it's a shame. I mean, he wasn't a young man, but he also wasn't terribly old. 61 is not really all that old anymore. There's also a rest in peace for Dick Van Patten, who was 86, and he died from complications to diabetes. He was diabetic, and I mean, he was 86. He was up there in years. Most people recognize him from Eight is Enough. I always remember him for his work with Mel Brooks. I mean, he was in High Anxiety. He was in Spaceballs. You see him show up in a lot of comedies, and even though he wasn't as active in his older years, he was still doing stuff well into the 2000s. The next piece of news, which takes us away from the sad angle, is finally Marvel found its new Spider-Man. Now, it's been rumored back and forth. Yeah, we've already had two series with Peter Parker, but that last series was kind of a misfire. Sony's trying to sort of sweep that one under the rug, and they're trying to get involved in the Marvel Universe. Tom Holland, who most people don't know, he's been in a lot of theater. He played Billy Elliot in London, and in movies, most recognizably in The Impossible, which was the one about the tsunami that came out a couple years ago, and then he was also in Locke, which came out last year. He played one of the kids, Tom Hardy's kids, but he's really not terribly well known outside of the theater audience in England, and he's 19, so he's very young, which is always a gamble because they want to make the teenage Spider-Man, because that's a character from the books, even though he got older and he was in his 20s, well into his adulthood by the time the series has been around for 60 years. Hopefully he doesn't like age in his 20s, because obviously Marvel likes to pick somebody for a role and then and stick with it. This is not Tom Holland, the actor who was in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and this is also not the director of Fright Night and Child's Play, two of my favorite horror movies from the 80s. This is a different Tom Holland. There's multiple Tom Hollands running around. Another piece of superhero news is Ben Affleck is now rumored to direct The Batman, which is scheduled, allegedly, to come out in November of 2018. This is a standalone Batman movie, of course, and of course he would star in it because he is, of course, the new Batman. Honestly, this is one of the best pieces of news I've ever heard. I hope that it's true, because I think Ben Affleck is one heck of a director. I really think he's fantastic. I'm fine with him being Batman, but I also like to see it getting away from the Christopher Nolan / Zack Snyder heavy, over-stylized work. I think Chris Nolan needs to just back up and walk away from the DC movies. He's had his chance. He did the Batman series, ran that into the ground, and while it's a neat series, he finalized it. And I think his influence of trying to make a grittier, heavier Superman damaged the property a bit. I'd like to see them move away from that heavy mindset of filmmaking. So I'd love to see, I hope that that's a true rumor, that Ben Affleck will actually direct. He's one of those people who can actually direct himself. This would be the best news that I've seen come out of DC's camp since Jason Momoa was cast as Aquaman. The last piece of news is somewhat disconcerting, and this all swerves into the whole Confederate flag, South Carolina thing. Now, I'm not going to get into a big debate or discussion about gun control. I'm not going to talk about the incident that happened in South Carolina. I'm not going to debate whether or not the Confederate flag should or should not be taken down. I mean, I have my own opinion on that, but that's not specifically what I'm talking about. There's a lot of blowback to the Confederate flag thing, and there's been a news story that came out that Warner, which licenses Dukes of Hazzard merchandise, is going to either stop production on the General Lee or just remove the Confederate flag off the toys. And if you don't remember, the General Lee was the Duke's car, and it has a Confederate flag on the top. Here's the problem. These are things that are part of the pop culture, and it's a misplaced rage at the Confederate flag. Yeah, a lot of people can use it as a sign of racism, but it's also a sign of Southern pride. I'm not from the South, so I don't get that, but I understand that, especially when the show was on in the 70s and 80s, the Confederate flag did not mean pro-slavery. The Civil War was not fought over slavery. I mean, slavery was ingrained into the Civil War, but the Civil War was fought over slavery as much as World War II was fought over the Holocaust. I mean, there's a lot of things going in on this. And while slavery, you can't remove slavery from the Civil War, that's not necessarily what it was about. And the Confederate flag was not about, hey, yes, let's keep black people in shackles, because most people in the South were not slave owners. They're fighting for the right to do what they want to do and secede as a country. It was essentially the Revolutionary War from a different perspective. I mean, when America declared its independence, England was like, no, you're part of England and we're going to fight for that. And that's essentially what happened with the Civil War. The outcome was different. The Union was preserved in the Civil War, and we did break away from England in the Revolutionary War. So slavery was an issue then, but it was not the driving issue of the war. A lot of people just say, oh, Confederate flag, that means that's evil, that's wrong. And now there's this talk about removing it from the pop culture. And I have a problem with that. I have a real problem with retroactively changing movies and art, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's the Dukes of Hazzard, but changing that. I remember when I got the DVD of Breakfast at Tiffany's, there's an incredibly racist character that Mickey Rooney plays, and it's impossible to edit him out of the movie. And no one should even try. You should not even think about editing out something that exists, because that's what it was. We should not be sanitizing our own pop culture. It exists that way, and that's the way it was, and people need to be mature about it and look and say, you know what? This may not be acceptable now, but this is the way it is. And it's always bothered me to see retroactive editing. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one isn't even a movie. It's based on a movie. Wet Hot American Summer got its own sizzle reel, I guess you can say. It's on Netflix in July 31st. Check out this trailer in the guise of a camp video.
Camp Firewood is more than just a summer camp. Camp Firewood is an idea, a promise, a way of life.
One, two, three.
Be at one with nature. The summer of your life is just around the corner.
Get yourself ready, baby. One, two, three, let's go.
The only thing that worries me about Wet Hot American Summer is everyone's like 15 years older. But I'm looking forward to it. I like David Wayne. I thought Wet Hot American Summer was really good. It just recently got a new Blu-ray release. This is one of the shows I'll be binge-watching at the end of July. The next one I want to talk about is Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension, opens on October 23rd.
Look at this camera.
And there's like obviously something going on here.
It's got all these knobs you can adjust.
Oh my god.
How do you hold that?
It's so big!
It's so big!
This is weird. I was seeing something, and there's this thing that I'm picking up with the camera.
Who is that?
Oh! I think this camera can see things you cannot see with the naked eye.
This is so cool.
I've heard of spirit photography before, I've just never seen it in person.
This is, of course, the latest Paranormal Activity movie. They're talking about getting rid of the series because they don't, quote, want to run it into the ground, even though it's been run into the ground. First of all, it doesn't look as herky-jerky as the last Paranormal Activity movie. Part 3 was okay, and Part 1 was fine, and Part 4 was terrible, but it at least wasn't too much in that mode of running around with the camera. 5, it was just like every other crappy found footage movie. It looks like this one's at least working to not be as frenetic. And it's also going to be in 3D, which is odd because it's a video movie. But I'm curious to see what they do. It's not at all an endorsement of the movie. It may be terrible, but it looks interesting. At least they threw in an extra gimmick. They're merging the gimmicks of found footage and 3D. So I'll be curious to see how that ends up. And with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Max and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk about some films. The first one I'm going to be talking about is Max. A military service dog is adopted by the family of his deceased trainer and helps uncover a local criminal force.
Nose of a dog, the heart of a Marine. Sounds like a hero to me.
We're so proud of you both.
Oh, you hear that, Max? Say hi.
Max bonded so closely with Kyle, he can't work with anyone else.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I gotta go take care of that dog.
Won't even let me touch him.
Max just has to know that you want him.
Animals can come down with post-traumatic stress the same as people can.
Max, it's okay. It's okay.
This one kind of flew under the radar for me. And I think there's a little bit of a mis-marketing going on from Warner Brothers on this one. Because just a month or so ago, they released Mad Max Fury Road, which was very good and a lot of fun. And now they're releasing a movie called Max. I know the difference, but you have to differentiate an incredibly similarly named movie. And also, Mad Max Fury Road is not a kid's movie. It's a rated R. It's an action movie. This is a family drama. I wanted this film to be one of two things. On one hand, I wanted it to be Mad Max Fury Road with dogs. Just shoot all of Mad Max Fury Road, redo it, but everybody's a dog. George Miller could go recreate the entirety of Mad Max Fury Road and just use puppies. And honestly, I think that would be like the greatest thing in the universe. Tell me that would not be a wonderful movie. It's not that. Even though the title treatment is like the same font as Mad Max. That's the other thing. It really looks like they're similar movies. Now, the other thing I was hoping more realistically, I was kind of hoping this would be a movie about a military service dog doing his job. I thought that's what it was going to be. I didn't watch any trailers before I even saw this movie. I'd seen the poster, and the poster shows the dog sitting there, and he's got his bulletproof vest on, and he's obviously in the field. He's in like Afghanistan or somewhere, you know, because he's in sort of this desert bombed out area. And I'm like, this actually looks kind of interesting. I kind of want to, what do dogs do over there? Because dogs have been used in the military service since like World War I. And there's a whole division of the armed services. I mean, it's not like Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, K-9 unit. But there are very specific duties that people have that are involved with these dogs. And I was fascinated by this. I mean, because the dogs are used to sniff out bombs and detect things. Because as great of technology as we have, we still can't reach the level of sensory technology that a dog's nose can. I'm not looking for an action movie, but I was hoping for The Hurt Locker with dogs, essentially. I was hoping for this dog doing its job. It's not that. It's like the first 5 minutes are about that. But then the handler gets killed and the dog shipped home and the dog has PTSD, because dogs can get that. Dogs are emotional creatures, and you put them in a high stress, dangerous environment, they're going to have the same emotional issues that humans do. So the dog's got PTSD and it's at home, and the trainer, his brother, younger brother, has to take care of him. And it turns into this Hallmark movie of a boy and his dog. It's essentially Air Bud, but the dog doesn't play basketball. And I didn't particularly enjoy that. I wanted it to be about Max, but it's not about Max. It's about the kid and the kid's relationship with his friends. He has these friends that are Mexican. There are more Mexican jokes in this movie than a Don Rickles routine. Every single time, they gotta remind you that they're Mexican. She goes and brings treats over, and of course, she doesn't just have snossages. Like one of the girls, the girl he likes. She doesn't have snossages, she has like taquitos. And I'm like, really? Seriously? This movie's so racist that every thing that the Mexican family does has to be Mexican. nobody just eats a sandwich. They got to have guacamole and tortillas. And I mean, that's really what they do. And they got to make jokes. And the kid and one of his friends, every single line is, oh, but you know, Whitey has to do this, man. I mean, it's just, it is so racist at times. It's not that great of a story. It's so cheesy and corny. And yeah, I guess it's a crowd pleaser, but it felt like a direct DVD movie. I mean, a lot. It really did. It felt like something that would have been like a direct-to-video Fox Faith title. You know, stuff like The Ultimate Gift and those kind of... It's better than The Identical. I mean, it wasn't like an overtly faith-based movie, but it felt like there's a certain level of quality that... And I may get in trouble for this from some people, but there's a certain level of quality to the faith-based movies that don't quite have the high production value. It's like listening to Christian rock. Because Christian rock sometimes, a lot of times, sounds like Christian rock. It doesn't quite sound like rock music. And there are some artists in the Christian rock field who are good enough to really kind of go head-to-head with the main artists. But a lot of Christian rock is not as good. In terms of music, is not as good as the highest quality stuff that's out there in whatever genre you're talking about. And that's what it felt like for this movie. So if you like that sort of thing, you like the Hallmark kind of movies, if you like these feel-good type of films, yeah, you might like this, but I didn't. I have to say that Max kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Next movie I want to talk about is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. A high school boy is forced by his mother to befriend a girl at school who has just been diagnosed with leukemia.
Your father and I want to talk to you about something sad. Rachel Kushner has been diagnosed with leukemia.
That sucks.
It sucks.
It sucks quite a bit.
You might be someone who could make Rachel feel better.
I don't need your stupid pity.
I'm not here because I pity you. I'm actually here because my mom is making me.
It's actually worse.
So if this was a touching romantic story, our eyes would meet and suddenly we would be furiously making out with the fire of a thousand suns. But this isn't a touching romantic story.
This was a big breakout hit from the Sundance Film Festival. It hasn't been crushing it in limited release. And that may be why they pushed the wider release up a little bit. It's very much an independent feel movie. When you hear that it won the dramatic prize at Sundance, it's not a big surprise. It feels like that kind of film. It certainly has some great moments. And the acting's very good. And the actors involved are good. And I think everybody commits. And it certainly has its heart in the right place. But my biggest problem with this movie is it seems very derivative. It borrows a lot from Wes Anderson's style. It has these like title cards that show up that are supposed to be clever, but I've seen them in every independent film since the 90s. And it doesn't seem to be that original. And it has the very typical surly teenage outlook. And it like derives from Heathers, this extreme version back in 1989. It was this extreme version of high school where it's like, well, you have this group and this group and this group. They do this in like Mean Girls where they've got everybody set up in groups. And that's really not the way high school works. It's a very dumbed down, simplistic term. And this kid finds his way to organize everybody into those pockets of people. He and Earl, the main character and Earl, they make these films. They're sort of spoof movies. They're fake films based on real titles. Like, and they change it. Like they take A Clockwork Orange and call it A Sockwork Orange. So they take these films and they reshoot them as really stupid movies. Movies about movie makers are a real challenge because they're so narcissistic to the movie makers actually making them. And you can have something that's cool that's inherent in the movie, like Son of Rambo. But this just seems kind of forced. It seems like they're like, well, we want to make a movie about filmmakers and cancer. Overall, it's a well-made movie, and it is touching, and it is bittersweet. I think it's really going to touch people in their teens, late teens, and into their 20s. That's who it's made for, not an old fart like me in my 40s. And maybe when I was going into college age, it would have been different. Ultimately, I just found it somewhat unremarkable. There's a lot of great stuff in this overall mildly unremarkable film. I'm still going to say that Me and Earl and the Dying Girl kind of rocks, but kind of just barely.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ted 2 and Big Game.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Open Gangnam Style.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing the show. Let's talk a little bit about some more movies. The next one I want to talk about is Ted 2. Ted and his new bride, Tammy Lynn, want to adopt a child, but the state declares Ted isn't actually a person, so he has to sue for his civil rights. Oh, and it also has a lot of weed and sex jokes.
So I got some big news.
Tammy Lynn and I are gonna have a baby.
That's awesome!
Oh my God, Teddy, look at this. It's as if we want to have a baby. You're going to have to prove you're a person in a court of law.
This is a nightmare.
We got to fight it. We'll get a lawyer and we'll sue the government for your civil rights.
I'm Samantha Jackson. You must be Ted.
Yeah, Samantha Jackson. What's your middle name?
Leslie.
Oh my God, you're Sam L. Jackson.
That's great. I mean, just like Sam L. Jackson.
Who is that?
You ever seen any movie ever? He's the black guy.
When the first Ted came out, I didn't know what to think about it. I was a little bit nervous going in. I thought it was a hoot. I thought the first Ted was a really funny movie. I'm also, just for disclosure purposes, I am not turned off by Seth MacFarlane. I know there's a lot of people out there that you either like him or you don't. And there's plenty of people out there that don't like Seth MacFarlane, but there obviously are plenty of people who do, evidenced by how well Ted 1 did and how well Family Guy and American Dad have done. Now, I think Family Guy is very funny. I think American Dad's very funny. I thought Ted, the first one, was very clever and had some incredibly funny moments. I also liked A Million Ways to Die in the West last year. I thought that was actually a really fun movie. It kind of disappointed me that it didn't do very well because I like that movie. Now, when a movie like Ted does well, it kind of came out of nowhere. No one expected it, and it became this big hit. And so afterwards, the studio, of course, says, hey, we need to make a sequel. And so they all get around, you have all the heads of in the studio and the creative team. They say, well, okay, let's make it. Well, what should it be about? And I have a feeling that it went down this way. Everyone said, what should this movie be about? It's a sequel. Well, I don't know yet, but let's start writing some jokes. And that's really what it felt like. It really felt disjointed. Now, generally, Seth MacFarlane's stuff is disjointed. I mean, he's known for these non sequitur scenes in Family Guy and American Dad, but definitely Family Guy. But there always seems to be a purpose to them. They all are jokes that emerge naturally out of these conversations. The problem with Ted 2 is it is so disjointed. It doesn't even have a sense of story. And when it does have a sense of story, it's really misplaced. At times, it honestly feels like they're trying to make a couple political points in this movie. And I'm here thinking, really, a movie about a talking bear that does too much weed is where you want to make political points? Because it fails miserably when it's trying to make points. And the other thing about it, and this is me becoming a prude, this is so weed heavy. And I understand that part of the first film was these two guys, the guy and his bear, they smoke too much pot. And they kind of overcome that. This is the problem with making a weed movie, is the stoner movies are funny because it's these losers who sit around and smoke too much weed. But then if you want to have any sort of character development, the characters have to get beyond that. And they did in the first movie. There was a little bit of like, well, you're sort of wasting your life. Okay. And then to make the movie work in the chemistry, they go right back to where it is. And then it is just nonstop weed jokes. And even to the point when they get Amanda Seyfried shows up and she's this junior lawyer who takes on the case pro bono, she's smoking a lot of weed. And I'm here thinking, really seriously, the junior lawyer who's never tried a case in her life, who smokes weed nonstop, has trouble proving a very simple case in all reality? It doesn't hold together. And it seems that this movie, they doubled down on the pot humor for two reasons. First of all, I think they wanted to capitalize on Colorado legalizing weed. I think they also wanted to capitalize on the rentability factor because movies like a lot of these stoner movies like Dude, Where's My Car and Harold and Kumar, these movies tend to do very well on home video. And they tend to be movies that get a lot of fame after the fact. And they don't necessarily do well in the movie theater because a lot of people who smoke too much weed don't have the energy or the ambition to get off the couch. But they're plenty good at sitting home and watching a movie over and over and over and over and over and over again on streaming or on DVD. This one has some funny jokes in it. Don't get me wrong. And there are funny things that happen in the trailer that then they see them in the movie. They're supposed to be funny, but generally if I've seen the gag a couple times in the trailer, it's no longer funny. And the funniest parts are in fact in the trailer. I don't know. I mean, it's a Ted movie directed by Seth MacFarlane. You should not expect too much of it. But the first one was clever and cute and fun. And this one just felt like they just stuck a bunch of jokes together with duct tape and bubble gum just to barely make a movie work. And the other thing is they got rid of Mila Kunis. Mila Kunis isn't in this movie for whatever reason, because I guess she was doing Jupiter Ascending. But they have to explain why she's not there. And generally, this always happens. And we'll talk about this when Magic Mike comes out next week. A lot of times when the sequel is made, there's somebody who doesn't come back. And then they have to explain why the person doesn't come back. And that kind of ruins sort of the chemistry from the first movie, because you work so hard to keep these people together and then they're not in there for whatever reason. And I'm not blaming Kunis for not being in this movie, but it just doesn't quite seem to work as a film. It's funny. And I'm sure if you're high, this is a genius piece of work. But outside of that, It just kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Big Game. This is an interesting film because it's not in a lot of theaters, but you can get it on demand this week. And I remember when it came out on my radar a couple months ago, I was like, this is interesting. I hope it gets a wider release. I'm sure it's in some theaters, but generally you're going to have to find it like in iTunes. In Big Game, the President of the United States is shot down in the wilderness of Finland, and a boy on his first solo hunting trip must rescue him from terrorists.
Welcome to Finland.
36 minutes ago, we got an evac distress signal from Air Force One.
I deliver it to President. You will wire the money as planned.
Find the President. Bring him home.
Someone helped him.
Men who shot me down. They're hunting me.
This movie was apparently made as a bit of a homage to 80s action movies. And it totally works in that respect. It really feels like something that Schwarzenegger would have starred in the 80s. It absolutely feels that. They nailed that. Now, it's a much smaller budget. It's a huge budget for a Finnish movie. But it's a small budget for just a regular action movie. I mean, a movie like this, if it were made in America, if it was a Hollywood film, it would be like $100 million at least. I think it was like $9 million what they did. They do a lot with that very little they have. But it really works. And I think that kind of plays into the fact that it is a throwback movie, because even the 80s, when they threw a lot of money at movies, they didn't have the massive budgets and the effects that they had available now. So they had to find ways to make action work with people just running through the woods instead of explosions and planes crashing. And this one works. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson plays a president, and that's a little bit unbelievable because, you know, black president, that's never going to happen. But anyways, you know, he plays the president and he works in the role. And I mean, I don't know if Samuel L. Jackson's the most presidential. I mean, like, Morgan Freeman's your typical, like, oh, that's the guy who's going to be president. But Samuel L. Jackson seems to be a little bit, he works as Nick Fury, not as much as the leader of the free world, but it works in this movie, and he's a big enough name, and I'm sure he just had fun with this. It looked like he got a trip to Finland out of it. It's directed by the guy who did Rare Imports, which is that movie about crazy Santa Claus type creatures emerging from the frozen wilderness. Rare Exports, by the way, is a great movie. You should check it out. But Big Game works as well. And I had a lot of fun with it. And it looks, it's exactly what you'd expect from the trailer. If you go see the trailer, this is one of those movies that really gives you that feel. It has a good cast. You know, Samuel L. Jackson, it's got Ray Stevenson. You've got a good, solid cast. You got the kid from Rare Exports, and he's good in it as well. but he's not well known in this. This is a fun movie. If you have a chance to see it, if it's in the theater, go see it in the theater, because it is a big screen kind of movie. It has some big explosions, and it definitely has scope, and they do a lot with that $9 million. But if it's not playing anywhere near you, take a chance and rent it on demand, because it's a good, fun action movie. It has a throwback feel to the 80s and absolutely works. So I'm going to have to say that Big Game rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for these movie reviews. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about another Sundance favorite, The Wolf Pack. Also, the box office and the world-famous DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Finishing up the reviews, I talked about Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance for Dramatics. Let's talk about the movie that won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries. That is The Wolf Pack. A group of homeschooled children in Manhattan's Lower East Side rely on movies as their creative outlet when they aren't allowed outside.
My parents didn't encourage us to communicate with society, so we were kind of shut off. Always lived in this apartment.
In the summer, there was more chance of us getting out. Sometimes we go out once a year. One particular year, we never got out at all.
So movies opened up another world. We didn't make any friends. We were homeschooled.
I did everything I could to escape my world.
Documentaries are sometimes a challenge to do simply because most people see movies as the narrative features and the big blockbusters, and documentaries don't get as much play. Yeah, you got ones that are directed by Michael Moore, and every now and then you get these big documentaries that everybody sees, but generally most documentaries fly under the radar. And it's odd because people watch TV and they're accustomed to watching essentially television documentaries when they see true life stories and that kind of programming. But you get some very unique ones. And The Wolf Pack is a unique documentary because it takes a different approach to it. And I like the fact that it does this because in the advent of Michael Moore and Morgan Spurlock to a lesser degree, there have been a lot of documentaries that become popular because they come up with a specific political point or they have a specific agenda. And they're less documentaries and more op-ed pieces and propaganda. Propaganda is a little bit harsh of a term because it has such a negative connotation, but that's really what they are. They're movies that are made to make a certain political point. This one isn't. These people stumbled across this fascinating family, and the story behind it is it's this father who's a little bit crazy in terms of wanting his own freedom. He's one of those people who wants so much freedom that he ends up becoming a prisoner, and his family becomes a prisoner because he doesn't want his kids to interact too much with society and the negative influences there. So he and his wife, they live in this apartment and they had these kids and they really just never let them go outside. And they had something like 6 or 7 kids. And it's kind of hard to believe that these people would just all live in this apartment. And you have to sit there and think, my gosh, what's it like in there? I mean, I know what it's like when I get cabin fever sometimes when it's cold and kind of snowed in the winter and you don't get out much. I get a little bit itchy after a couple weeks if I'm not out enough just to run around. I can't imagine what it would be like in this crappy little New York apartment. But that was this family's life. What these kids do is they end up, their outlet to the outside world is movies. And they would watch the movies and then they'll go through and they'll write the scripts out of the movies and then perform them in their own video productions. If you're a parent, you see this happen to the kids and you understand the process that you go through. Because when you have a kid and when it's a baby, the kid's completely reliant on you. And as the kid gets to become a toddler and young, you know, 5, 6 years old, they love you, and there's nobody greater than your mom or dad. But then you hit adolescence, and it goes from this reverence to sometimes cynicism, sometimes overt hatred, depending on your family. But there's going to be a rebellious stage because kids want to become free. They want to do their own thing. They don't want to be under you. And the thing with kids is they always change. And you have a snapshot of any sort of period of their life, but they change and they become their own people. And that's very hard for parents to deal with. And it's obviously very hard for the family, the mom and dad, to deal with these kids. Really, it's a story about the kids and how they developed and how they wanted to come out and experience the real world and how they kind of do and how they start rebelling against their father's rules. But I kind of wanted to know more about the mom and the dad and kind of how they got to this position. They interview them and you kind of get this disjointed, haphazard explanation as to why they're like this. But I kind of wanted to know the greater story behind it. But really, the movie's about the kids and how they come out of their shell. And it's an interesting movie. I wouldn't say that it's a great documentary because it's not like a feat of filmmaking. It's just a fascinating subject. The movie, like The Wolfpack, you don't see very many documentaries like this, and it's very different. But that's okay because it's an interesting movie. So I'm going to have to say The Wolfpack kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, was I correct? I was a lot closer with my Jurassic Park prediction. I said the Jurassic World was going to make $100 million. I just said evenly $100 million. It actually made $106.5 million. And that's significant because that bested the Avengers second weekend record of $103 million. It's the only other movie that has made over $100 million in its second weekend, which is phenomenal. And again, it's almost unprecedented success for this movie. I didn't predict this. Nobody else really did. I'm sure Universal is over. Do you remember when Universal couldn't release a movie to save their life? Remember when they were releasing movies and they all kind of fizzled and they were, you know, it's stuff like, even like 3 years ago, they had Battleship. That was one of their big summer tent poles. And even a couple years before that, they had Couples Retreat. I remember Couples Retreat was like the only movie that did well that year for Universal, aside from maybe an animated film. But now Universal's on top of the world because not only do they have Jurassic World, but they had Furious 7 that came out a couple months ago. Those are two of the biggest movies of the year. So yeah, it topped Avengers second weekend. It made a little bit more because Avengers made only $103 million its second weekend, the first Avengers. A couple other records that Jurassic World has hit. It crossed $1 billion worldwide in just 13 days. Which is 4 days faster than Furious 7. Now, those aren't great one-to-one comparisons because the international market has opened up so well, and there's like $200 and some million from China alone, which really wasn't available just a couple years ago. But still, that shows the impact and the spread of these movies. It is also the fastest movie to $500 million, made that its opening weekend, the fastest movie to $400 million domestically. So it's probably going to top out close to $600 or more when it's done with its run, and may actually beat the Avengers for domestic box office. Still not going to beat Titanic or Avatar. And it also makes Universal the fastest studio to hit $3 billion in worldwide receipts. That's, of course, thanks to Jurassic World and Fast and Furious, which makes up the lion's share of that $3 billion. Oh, and not to be outdone, Inside Out did $90 million. It's amazing that you can have a movie open with $90 million and not win the box office, which is phenomenal. It's, I think, the second highest opening of a Pixar movie ever, because Toy Story 3 did better. But it's also the biggest opening for an original movie ever, something that's not a sequel, which is fantastic. I mean, Inside Out's no slouch. Inside Out's a bona fide hit. It's huge. So just because it came in second, the ranking is kind of irrelevant on this one. Dope only did $6 million. That's actually not very good. That's a little low for what people were hoping. This week, I think you're still going to see Jurassic World top the box office. I'm going to say $60 million because even though Avengers made $55 in its third weekend, Jurassic World is dropping slower. It didn't drop as far in its first to second weekend, and so I think it's going to make a little more than the third weekend of Avengers. So I'm going to just say flat $60 million for Jurassic World will still take top of the box office. I think Ted 2 is going to be a little soft because it's a sequel, and it's not a sequel that can build on itself. Like Pitch Perfect definitely had its fans, so when it did the sequel, even though the sequel was not as good as the first movie, it built on those fans. I think people are starting to get tired of Seth MacFarlane, especially considering how poorly A Million Ways to Die in the West did last year. I don't think it's going to be great for the cards for Ted 2. And then Max, I think, is going to be somewhat middling because it is just a family movie when all is said and done. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. It's kind of a weak time for DVDs this week. There's Timbuktu, which is a foreign film. It was nominated for an Academy Award in the foreign language film. Serious film about cattle farmers in Timbuktu who are facing Islamic extremists under the ISIL flag, and it's them having to deal with that issue. There's some cheesy stuff out there. There's The Forger, which stars John Travolta as a painter who gets out of prison to see his son, but then it's arranged to have him involved in some sort of art heist. Pound of Flesh, which is about Jean-Claude Van Damme chasing down his kidney after it was stolen from him. That's a ridiculous... That feels like that movie should have been made in the 90s. Workaholics Season 5, the Comedy Central show, is available. Teen Beach 2, which is the latest Teen Beach movie from Disney Channel. Instead of going into the teen movie, the teens come out of the teen movie into the real world. If There Be Thorns, yet another V.C. Andrews adaptation with Heather Graham. An American Girl, Grace Stirs Up Success, another in the long line of American Girl movies. You know I'm a huge fan of those. And then Curious George 3, Back to the Jungle, direct to video, but hey, it's Curious George. It's a monkey. It's got to be good for kids. The stinger of the week is Young Hercules, the complete series, because Ryan Gosling played Hercules, and that's the only reason it's getting a release. This was part of that Hercules, a Legendary Journey, Xena Warrior Princess canon, and no one remembers this one, but the only reason it's significant is because it stars a young Ryan Gosling, and people just want a quick cash grab for him. That's it. I need to go for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Terminator Genisys and Magic Mike XXL. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.